Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business. This is the podcast we do every week based on the Seriously Risky Business newsletter, which is written by our good friend, Tom Uren. And this podcast is made possible thanks to the support of the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative and also through sponsorships from OstCyber, CyberCX, and Proofpoint. So Tom is joining me now to talk through this week's Seriously Risky Business newsletter. And Tom, we got a few things to get through, but let's start at the beginning. And the Financial Times wrote a very interesting story about how the Ministry of State Security is recruiting Chinese students who are learning English. They're recruiting them to like translate documents that the MSS has stolen through espionage activity. And while on some levels this isn't actually that surprising, it is still extremely different to the way that Western intelligence agencies tend to do things, right? That seems to be what comes through most in your reporting.
Yeah, when I read this article, the first thing that struck me is that that's just so different from Western intelligence recruitment. So I think when we were talking about this before, I described Western intelligence agencies as very sober and serious. And like, you recruit people, you tell them what you put out an ad. I mean, we recruit from the same places, we recruit from universities, but you put out an ad, you tell people what you're going to do, and you have this really rigorous selection process that vets you both for what you know and what you can do, but also your sort of sympathies to make sure you're the you know, a trustworthy person. And this just seemed so different. And I really wanted to understand why it was different. Is that just something culturally Chinese? Is it a deliberate strategy?
Well, I mean, one thing that's worth pointing out here is that they were actually giving the students classified documents they'd stolen from the United States to translate in as part of the interview process, right? Which seems they don't care. They just don't seem to care.
Yeah. And they were, I think the other interesting thing is they were getting them to do, I guess I'd call it target development on Johns Hopkins. So a legitimate target that they could very well try and hack. So it's really, I mean, kudos for giving realistic test tasks, but it just seems so bizarre. So I spoke to Alex Joski. So Alex he's writing a book on the MSS, and he's written a lot of reports on how the Chinese Communist Party and their intelligence agencies operate. And I was asking him, you know, is this just the way the Chinese government rolls? And he was like, yeah. He said that Chinese ministries, any kind of serious ministry, will have many, many companies that it operates. And some of those will be just companies that do stuff.
I mean, did we even mention that, and it's probably worth bringing up at this point, that they were doing this through a front company? So it's we should have mentioned that at the beginning. But yeah, I mean, what you found by talking to Alex is that there are so many of these companies that belong to the ministries, and they might do everything from property management to maintaining the engines on a car fleet or whatever. And apparently corruption is rife within these companies as well. But it's sort of weird where even the non-intelligence agencies have these kind of corporatized cutouts, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Alex said that company could be doing a job totally unrelated to the ministry. And there'll be just a few intelligence officers sprinkled through it, and the rest of the employees are just regular employees. So it's really just standard business to use and be related to companies. So one example he gave, in the 90s, there was a particular push to get rid of extraneous companies, and the MSS got rid of literally hundreds of companies. So some of them were just shut down, but others were passed on to other bureaucracies where the functions were more relevant. So it seems like this is just the way they do business.
Yeah, and it was funny because you and I were sitting there trying to think of why China shouldn't do this. And of course, to our delicate Western eyes, this just looks crazy. But then you think, well, they know that we know that they're doing this sort of espionage. They haven't stopped. Exposing the behavior doesn't seem to have really moderated it. So it is shameless, but what's the risk to them from doing this? It doesn't seem to be one, like nothing tangible anyway.
We know that they're stealing stuff from us. They know that they're stealing stuff from us. So what's the harm in a few students in China also knowing the other interesting thing Alex said was they've got a lot more tolerance for engaging third parties. So that sort of plays into hiring front companies or using companies in the first place. So now the typical phrase that's used by Western diplomats is front companies. You know, they're hiding behind their MSS affiliation behind a front company. But it, to me, this just seems like they just use companies for all sorts of things that we wouldn't.
Yeah, it's probably more of an administrative thing than an attempt to obfuscate or you know, muddy attribution, right? And you know, something that you and I were talking about while we were editing, going through the edit of this week's newsletter, is that you would think that the risk to the Chinese MSS of being infiltrated by a student who happens to be like an agent or an asset of a foreign intelligence organization, you know, the odds of that are probably vanishingly low. Whereas if, say, the United States or, you know, any Five Eyes SIGINT agency or intelligence agency were to go to a university in their country and attempt to recruit Chinese speakers, that would be risky. Right.
Yeah, yeah. I think the other thing here is that by using companies that are associated with a particular department in Hainan Island of the MSS, it's really quite compartmentalized. So you could have a Chinese student working for that company and know nothing at all about the broader MSS or anything beyond really what they're translating. And so there's perhaps not even a lot of value in Western intelligence knowing that you're translating a particular document. You'd just probably be better off working on your own cybersecurity rather than investing that effort to get what you'll probably find out anyway, because their OPSEC is not that good.
What was funny, it was funny actually from FT, one of the things that kind of came through in their reporting was that for some of these students, they really didn't want the gig, because the reason they were learning English in the first place is because they were quite interested in being able to work abroad and were smart enough to realize that, hey, if I wind up becoming associated with this activity, I'm probably not going to be welcomed to, say, the United Kingdom with open arms, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that seems like the Chinese, well, the MSS in this case is quite happy to place that risk on people they employ. The other really interesting thing I thought that Alex said is that the MSS has been involved in cybersecurity for a long time. He said that Shanghai Jiao Tong University, which has been associated with several hacks, including Operation Aurora back in the 2000s. So the very first professor of cybersecurity there, or the founder of that school, had retired from the MSS. So there's close links from the very beginning there. And he also said it's not uncommon for MSS officers to hold academic posts at universities. So they're really in a position to find talent early and bring them into the fold very quickly.
Well, and this is where your piece winds up, right? Which I think is fascinating, which is, okay, this looks really weird to us, but clearly it's working. And there's probably some lessons we can take away from this as you know, in terms of different ways that we could actually think about our intelligence services.
Yeah, I think the two things were the engagement with external third parties. Certainly in the past, the intelligence agencies have been very secret squirrel. So it's hard for them to find talent elsewhere, but also get different perspectives and different views. And I think the world, that made sense when SIGINT was signals intelligence. But it doesn't really make sense when the whole world does cybersecurity. So there's got to be a different paradigm there. I see them changing, but it's slowly.
Yeah, well, the risk appetite from what we can tell has gone up. And I think one thing that's pushed that along a little bit is the reliance of a lot of signals intelligence agencies. Don't get me wrong, they've got an amazing amount of expertise internally for doing things like exploit development and you know, payload development. But they do often turn to external providers for some of that stuff. And they've had to do that. And that's been going on for about 10 years. So, you know, who knows? Maybe that's cracking the door just enough that we might see, you know, summer camp jobs translating stolen Chinese documents, right? Who knows? I wouldn't hold my breath, though. All right, let's move on to the next story. And, you know, let's talk about some lower-level corporate espionage. The Reuters team, I think it was Rafael Satter and Chris Bing over at Reuters, they've been doing excellent work over the last few years, really diving into some of these hacker-for-hire companies, mostly based in India. They did the original coverage of Beltrox, which is a company that was doing things like stealing access to people's Gmail accounts and stuff on behalf of whoever gave them money. They've published a report in which they somehow got their hands on the target set for a bunch of these companies in India, and have done a really fascinating write-up on the breakdown of you know, who these hacker-for-hire companies are typically used to target. And of course, thanks to some of their other reporting, we've seen that often it's a private investigator will be used as a type of cutout to commission these services on behalf of their clients, who might be hedge funds, lobby groups, law firms, whatever. They just ask the private investigator to get some information and, you know, say, well, we don't know if they did anything illegal, sort of thing, hence me describing them as a cutout. But what did we learn from this target set, Tom?
I think the thin edge of the wedge is getting a bit thicker. And what I mean by that is that Citizen Lab published about Beltrox, and we've learned more and more about what they're doing and how at the, and the scale that they're operating at, and also some of their clients. And so this is, this particular article is about one particular set of linked companies, but there's got to be more companies, but we can see that they're actually targeting litigation. So that to me goes to the core of fairness and equity. Buying the result of litigation by stealing confidential material, I think that really is very, very problematic for the judiciary and the legal system.
So do you mean to say that when we peel back the curtains on a bunch of really malicious, dodgy stuff, what is behind that curtain is a bunch of lawyers? you don't tell me. That's a giant surprise. But yeah, it does look like there's a lot of skullduggery going on in the legal world where they are attacking lawyers, presumably to get a bit of an edge when it comes to legal disputes, right, and litigation. So as you're saying, by getting this information, they might be the people who are pulling the strings on this stuff might be actually buying an outcome in the courts, which of course undermines the judiciary. It's quite bad, really.
They're certainly trying to buy an outcome, and the report has a few examples of particular cases. But of course, the cases where they're successful, the malicious peoples in influencing the outcome, no one wants to talk about it. So I think it's an excellent investigative effort, and I'm kind of waiting to see what's the next thing that drops. What are those things that drop?
The shoe. Is it the shoe? I don't know. Something's going to drop. now, look, one story that we did speak about in the main Risky Business podcast, and look, full credit, you've given credit here as well, full credit to CyberScoop for doing a fantastic write-up on how Microsoft's recent reports about what's happening in Ukraine with regard to, you know, cyber attacks originating from Russia, how Microsoft's reports have kind of missed the mark. And they're saying, oh, look at cyber war and the front lines of the conflict run through Redmond, and just really being quite self-important and douchey and not that accurate. You've gone for a much more sort of, you know, we had a ha-ha conversation about this on the main show, but you've gone a little bit deeper than that and really looked at explaining why the examples Microsoft are citing of, you know, cyber war things happening are anything but.
Yeah, so the phrase that Microsoft used in their report was that it was a combined use of cyber and conventional weapons. So that implies to me that both of those things are doing something destructive. But when you look at the text, it actually says, well, we found some hackers on a network, and then the next day the company was attacked. The nuclear power plant they were talking about was attacked physically. And that to me is not combined cyber and military weapons or conventional weapons. So we actually...
No, and it's worth mentioning too, like we have a weekly editorial meeting here at Risky Biz HQ, and you and myself and Catalin Kimpanu were all on a call, and he used a line that I just really liked, which is he said, look, Ukraine's a big country. And eventually a missile is going to hit something that's being DDoSed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
and that's the way he saw it. And it really hit home for me too, that that line.
Yeah. So I think what Microsoft is describing as combined is mostly appears to be just coincidental. Or if not coincidental, you know, they've got a common goal, but they're not integrated and working together. So I look in the at a couple of examples, which I think are good examples of what an integrated op would really be like. So one of them is from the Russian invasion, which is the disruption of KASAT. So there was a lot of Ukrainian military communications on that network. So obviously, yeah, disrupting communications is going to have an impact on their warfighting ability. So we don't know how big that impact was, but there's a clear straight line between action and maneuver on the ground, like they invaded in the hours after they disrupted. And then I look at another example that was actually from the Australian Signals Directorate. The US has also spoken about this type of event publicly, but the ASD disrupted ISIS communications in Syria at the same time as there was an attack on the ground. So very much, in fact, like the KASAT example, but that just disrupted the foreign fighters' ability to coordinate. And so therefore, you know, a great military win. So that's what it means to be a coordinated cyber and conventional weapons. It's not happening at the same time in the same place. It's one effect amplifying the
other. You've got this great line in here, which is, it looks to us like simultaneous targeting rather than Russian cyber and conventional forces operating to achieve reinforcing effects. And it's funny, right, because you've been with us for about a year, and this is a drum that you beat loudly and often, which is that it isn't just about doing a cyber thing and doing a explodey thing at the same time. It really is about doing these things in concert in order for each one to sort of have an effect on the other. Right? Like it can't just be. And look, Catalan pointed out something interesting, and again, we covered this on the main show, this aspect of it, which is that a lot of these sort of DDoS groups popping up coming out of Russia look pretty obviously kind of state-sponsored, backed, or even operated. And the idea is to counter the narrative that Ukraine is the only country that has an IT army that's happy to go out there and cause mayhem, right? And yeah, so you got these DDoS is happening at the same time as military action on the ground. Those aren't things that are reinforcing each other, you know?
Yeah. So the Ukrainian cybersecurity official, Viktor Zhora, spoke about he called it a combined attack on DTEC, which is their energy supplier, electricity, and a thermal energy plant. I presume that's coal. But anyway, that was being shelled at the same time as there was a cyber attack. And it's like, well, what's the point of the cyber attack if you're just going to blow up the facility?
Right? So it, like, and when the shells are coming and landing on your buildings, you know, you're not really going to be worried so much about not being able to access your Gmail.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. And these attacks could be coordinated in the sense that there's a common goal to disrupt Ukrainian electricity supply. Okay, so we'll launch different attacks at different places at different times. That's not, I think, complementary action or integrated action.
No, I mean, that's something we've been over before, which is that, you know, you're going to have overlap in your target sets for the people doing the DDoS versus the people doing the, you know, missile launches and whatever. So, look, if people would like to deep dive into that, you can check out the Seriously Risky Business newsletter at risky.biz/subscribe. Now, the last thing that we are going to talk about today, Tom, and it was quite annoying to me actually running yesterday's show and publishing it, the other Risky Biz podcast, when I'd had a briefing on this, but it was still embargoed, so I couldn't talk about it. But Apple has launched a thing it's calling Lockdown Mode. Well, it is launching it as part of iOS 16. I think the beta is coming soon, or the beta for our American friends. And really what they do is you can put your device into a much more secure state. It removes functionality. It will prevent people who you have not FaceTimed with from FaceTiming you. It will remove things like quick previews from iMessage. It does a lot of stuff, really minimizes the attack surface. And it is designed chiefly for people who are quite concerned about their safety, right? So these people who've been targeted by organizations like NSO Group at the behest of their horrible customers. The idea here is, you turn on your lockdown mode, it makes it much less likely that you are going to get owned by some of this commercial grade spyware. So I think it looks to me, you know, having sat in the briefing, like they took us through it, it actually looks really good. It looks like it's going to work. It's going to make it a great deal harder for some of these contractors to actually get on these devices. The flip side of that, of course, is that it's going to make it considerably harder for SIGINT agencies and law enforcement to get on these devices as well if this mode is enabled.
So I thought that was that's a really interesting angle. I was really surprised by how strong lockdown mode is. My initial thought when I heard about it is, oh, it'll probably be something I'll turn on. And then...
I had the exact same reaction in the briefing. I'm sitting there going, geez, this is a bit serious.
And some of the functionality you lose, I think, will be really quite painful for many people. So the question is whether criminals will adopt it. I'm not so sure. Like, they don't seem to trust anything commercial. But I think perhaps maybe it's a matter of just social networks. Most of the crime phones seem to be sold by people in that community. So yes. Is someone in that community going to take up and promote Apple iPhones in lockdown mode as the thing to do? Who do you trust? And I guess you trust people that you know. One of the interesting...
Well, which is why you get AnchorChat and Anom and all of these crime phones.
One of the tweets I saw, I think from John Scott Railton at Citizen Lab, was that this actually gives them an answer when an activist says, I've been targeted. You've just told me I've been targeted, but what can I actually do? And so now I guess the answer is, well, you were targeted, turn on lockdown mode. What occurred to me is that there's many, many people who don't believe that they're targets until it's too late. I think that's the typical response. For many people, I'm not that important than anyone would bother. And so I guess this gives you maybe it's a second chance after you learn you've been targeted to actually just flick a switch and be better off.
We're going to see more about this lockdown mode when it comes out as part of iOS 16. Hopefully the people who need it, hopefully it's of a benefit to them. I do feel like when there's a will, there's always a way. And perhaps someone will be able to develop tooling that will be able to get onto these phones. But it occurs to me that just by making that much more difficult and much more expensive, it means that that tooling will have to be used vanishingly sparingly. And it just probably won't be worth it to put it on a human rights activist's phone. Like, the economics of that won't stack up, whereas you could probably still use that technique against a head of state, for example. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I 100% agree. Like, the making security harder does make people invest in OPSEC. And OPSEC is good for everyone because a lot of OPSEC makes it hard to deploy widely.
All right. Well, Tom Uren, thank you so much for joining me for this talk through of this week's Seriously Risky Business newsletter. It's been a pleasure to chat to you, my friend, and we'll do it again next week.
Thanks, Matt.